It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Sometimes medicine is miraculous. 50 years ago, a cancer diagnosis meant likely death. Today, many cancers can be cured, and some cancers can be prevented. Among them are cancers associated with the human papillomavirus, which causes a handful of them. All it takes is a series of two or three vaccines, but many teens don't get them, and many health providers don't insist. Dr. James Conway is frustrated by this. He is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. More specifically, he is a pediatric infectious disease specialist who works with programs both domestically and globally to improve the lives of children. And one of his areas of focus is improving systems for prevention by strengthening immunization programs. Dr. Conway joins us now. Welcome, sir.
Good morning.
So let's talk first about just what is HPV?
So HPV, or human papillomaviruses, are a whole collection of viruses. There's well over 100 of them, and they're incredibly common. Most people are infected at some point during their life, and they're really only transmissible in most situations from person to person.
And is it always sexually transmitted, or are there other ways that it can be transmitted?
Oh, no, they're much more readily transmitted, and they're much more common. For instance, plantar warts, which many people have experienced, are actually caused by a type of human papillomavirus. People that get laryngeal polyps and things in their mouths and throats are generally caused by HPV as well. So they're not just by sexual activity. They're really by any kind of skin or mucosal contact between people.
And can all of the various HPV varieties cause cancer?
No, there's a smaller group of them that are typically associated with cancers. The other ones cause things like genital warts and plantar warts and things like that. So there's just a few of them that are, at this point at least, known to cause most of the cancers that we see.
And do we know how many people in this country have those few that cause the cancers?
We do, and that was part of what, as people were trying to figure out the best approach to using these vaccines. You know, we know that there's probably about 79 million Americans currently that are already infected by HPV. There's probably about 14 million new HPV infections every year, and they're most common in young adults and teenagers.
The vaccine, we've figured out a vaccine. What does it do? Does it 100% prevent cancer?
So these vaccines have been around for a while, and they've evolved. I mean, the first ones came out in 2006, and basically what they do is they provide the human body with the idea that it's already seen these viruses, and so it develops immunity that then when it is confronted by one of these viruses, it can fight it off.
When are we supposed to get this? And I guess let's get to the nitty-gritty here. Why aren't people getting it?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of different issues with these. So the vaccines are routinely recommended for all adolescents at 11 and 12 years of age. Originally, when they came out, they were recommended to be three doses. The age range that people are eligible for these are ages 9 to 26. Are sort of the key ages. We really would strongly recommend that people complete their immunization series before their 13th birthday, because we know that that essentially predates most of the types of activity where people will come into contact with these kinds of viruses, whether it's actual true sexual intercourse or just close contact with others. So the idea is really to be fully immunized by the time you're 13. The good news that we found over some time was that we only really need two doses as long as you get the vaccines before you're 15, because the immune system just has such a better response to these things. And so that's yet another incentive to get started early. And, you know, I think when you ask about why people have been slow to embrace these, I mean, I think there was some hesitancy in the beginning. It was a new model of a vaccine. And although there were two other vaccines that came out at the same time, the Tdap vaccine, which is the one that everybody gets primarily as a tetanus and a whooping cough booster at 11 and 12 years of age, mm-hmm. and then the meningococcal vaccines, they all came out in 2006. But I think those vaccines were sort of improved models of vaccines that had been around for a long time. This was really a new thing, and so I think there was a little bit of hesitancy in the beginning. The other thing was that it was originally just earmarked for young women. And so I think there was also some hesitation, just because it seemed like such a strange thing to only recommend it for one part of the population. And as we've studied things more, we realize that HPV affects males and females quite a bit. There's, you know, almost 10,000 cervical cancer cases every year caused by HPV, but there's also almost 9,000 oropharyngeal cancers, primarily in males, that are caused by HPV. So we finally realized after a few years that this was a vaccine that actually should be broadly offered for everybody and should be equitably available for everybody. And so that's sort of how things evolved over the first couple of years after the vaccine first came out. So by 2010, it was really a routine recommendation that all males and females should get it.
And yet that doesn't seem to be happening. What's the vaccination rate in this state?
Vaccination rate for people, for young women, you know, we're probably seeing about 50% of them have gotten their some of their vaccines, but only about 40% of young women have actually completed their series. Some systems are better than others, but, you know, we really have a long way to go. If you compare it to the Tdap immunization rates that are, you know, well over 90%, and the meningococcal rates, you know, even without a school entry requirement, are around 85%. So we really have some work to do.
So Tdap, though, is a school requirement. HPV is not. Are you working to make that happen?
I think there's a lot of discussion about that. You know, I mean, similarly, there's no school requirement for the meningococcal vaccines either. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting that people, I think just because it's a scary disease, even though it's incredibly rare, you know, people have been much more willing to go that route. The HPV vaccines, you know, like I said, I'm a little frustrated and, you know, sometimes even baffled. I mean, we've got a vaccine that actually can prevent one of the more common causes of cancers in males and females, and in some ways should be a no-brainer. I mean, it could really change an entire generation. And I think, like I said, it was a new model of a vaccine. I think part of the problem actually goes along with the age groups and who does the vaccines, because, you know, if you think about when people show up with their HPV cancers, it's usually in their 30s and 40s and 50s. And so I think there was a little bit of a disconnect for the pediatricians, who were largely the ones vaccinating, that they don't have the experience with the disease itself. And I think it's a lot easier when you're talking to somebody about a vaccine and say, oh, yeah, I've seen pertussis, it's terrible. You know, I've seen meningococcus, it's horrible. It's a little harder for pediatricians because they don't really see the disease. And so I think, you know, in the beginning, we realized that we needed to do a lot more education for the providers themselves to make sure they understood the disease, because this was really a new thing that was kind of dumped on their lap.
And insurance pays for this, yes?
Oh, insurance pays for it. The Vaccines for Children program that underwrites vaccines for underserved populations pays for it. This is a routinely covered, nobody should be having to pay out of pocket for anything like this.
So as we're going back to school and parents are taking their kids, especially their 11, 12, 13-year-old kids in, they should also add the HPV vaccine to the vaccines that they're getting to go to school.
Absolutely. I mean, this should basically be a routine for every kid. I think every kid deserves the opportunity to be able to prevent cancer in their lives, and that's really what this is all about. And, you know, you can start as early as age 9 to get started so that you have the best opportunity to complete this. But this is really something that I think every kid deserves to have the opportunity to have. And, you know, parents need to push their providers as much as providers need to be routinely recommending this with all the other routine vaccines that, you know, really can change an entire generation.
James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. He focuses on improving systems for prevention by strengthening immunization programs, and HPV is one of the immunization programs that he wants more people to get. Dr. Conway, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're going to explore the true cost of knee replacement, one of the most common surgeries outside of childbirth. But first, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot this year, asking people around the state what issues are important to them this election season. Healthcare has come up a lot. Today, the State Insurance Board is set to decide if certain services will be provided for transgender employees. As Patty Murray reports, people are paying attention to how policymakers treat the issue this election season. We don't seem to have that here. For more information on how to get involved or share your year in election story, you can visit Beyond the Ballot. Visit WPR.org/ballot. We're going to talk about a hospital in La Crosse that is getting better outcomes from its knee surgery replacement. We got it? Do we have the thing? Okay, we're going to play it right now.
It's late July's Pride Fest in Green Bay, where Alexandra Batts talks about her frustration navigating a private employer's health insurance program.
Speaking as a Black trans woman, it's insanely difficult. I'm happy I have insurance, but it's not the right insurance. And the more I keep trying to find out more answers, the more confusing it gets.
Batts recently moved from Racine to Menasha and says she feels bad that she doesn't know who her local officials are. She would like to ask them about health coverage for trans people.
What would you do for people who are still trying to figure out health care, especially with the LGBT community? And why not? What would you do to make our state overall number one throughout the entire nation? Like I said, I remember a time when Wisconsin was like number one, like we beat out all the other states. Why are we like number 50?
Batts isn't alone. Jay Botsford of the Wisconsin Transgender Health Coalition says both public and private employees have to navigate a complicated system.
If you're a state employee or an employee of one of the municipalities that's on a state municipal plan, you have no coverage for anything related to transition for your health care. And then for private individual and group plans, it really depends on the employer or the individual plan that's offered on the exchange.
In 2016, the State Group Insurance Board approved coverage of services related to what it calls gender reassignment or sexual transformation. But less than a year later, the board reversed that decision. This affected state employees like Sebastian Greenholtz, who's a trans man.
The routine blood test to test the level of testosterone and estrogen in my blood went from costing me nothing to costing me upwards of $500.
This week, the State Group Insurance Board will meet to consider reinstating that coverage. The Wisconsin Transgender Health Coalition is asking the state to cover surgery and hormones for sex reassignment. Sebastian Greenholtz believes elected politicians don't relate to what's going on in his life or that of, say, women in search of birth control.
It just drives me nuts that person is empowered to make decisions about a health care issue that does not affect them at all.
The Group Insurance Board has until the end of the year to make coverage decisions. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For more information or to get involved and share your election year story with Beyond the Ballot, you can just go to WPR.org/ballot. Now, one of the solutions to the high healthcare costs is to have patients shop around. But getting a hospital to tell you the price of a procedure is nigh on impossible. A Wall Street Journal piece details how one hospital in La Crosse, actually, didn't even know the costs for one of its most common surgeries, which is knee replacement. It found out its costs were drastically lower than the price it was charging insurance companies and individuals, and it found that there was waste in the system. What do you think about the cost of healthcare versus the price of healthcare? Have you ever tried to find out how much a procedure is, and have you been in a position where you didn't have time to shop around? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet WPR Mornings. We're going to be talking to Melanie Evans now. She is a hospital reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And one of her latest pieces is, what does knee surgery cost? Few know, and that's a problem. Melanie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the world of knee replacements, you write that hospitals are often ignorant about the actual costs of procedures. I have a hard time wrapping my head around that.
That's understandable. So hospitals historically have used kind of a broader, I guess, they've looked at costs at a higher level. Sort of not, they haven't looked at the cost of a specific procedure, but they may have tracked the costs of the department mm-hmm. that performs that procedure, or they may be looking at a group of specialists, and they might track the costs at that level. It's not that they don't have a kind of a higher level picture of mm-hmm. their costs. They've also used basically proxies, like approximations. They've kind of, as they try to calculate what these costs are and project how they may change or how they're, you know, so that they can kind of price in some of that growth in their expenses, mm-hmm. They've used kind of, they use approximations, as I said, or proxies. But when it comes to knowing the specific cost of a procedure, that is not work that a lot of hospitals have done. And so when I was working on this story, what I had hoped to do was find one of those few hospitals that had actually decided to get very, very specific about their costs, to understand them down to the minute, like mm-hmm. what it cost them to perform a procedure. And the hospital that I found was Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is part of the Gunderson Health System.
And you found, they found that they were wildly overestimating their costs. And did they lower them when they figured that out?
Yeah. So they did this painstaking work following patients through the process, you know, from the clinic appointments, through like arriving at the hospital the day of the surgery, through, you know, pre-op, through the surgery itself, leaving the surgery, being transferred to the orthopedic unit, everything that happened through their discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And by discharge, I mean, you know, that's the point at which, when you're a patient, you hopefully just head home. So many patients go to, maybe they might end up going to rehabilitation facility as well. But so they do all of this painstaking work, and prior to that, they actually did not even have an estimated cost. So they didn't know. It wasn't that they could say, well, here's what our costs were before, and here's what they are now. They just didn't have it. And so what they did is they found sort of like a, what they called like an average range. You know, once they did all that work and analyzed all the information, they found that they had this average range. So the high end of that average range was about $10,550.
Mm-hmm.
For that was the cost to them to essentially produce a new knee. And then what they did is, as they kind of like, they looked at that whole process, that whole journey in the patient, and they said, what works and what doesn't? And by doing that, they picked apart the entire process and made some changes, some really interesting ones. And at the end of that, they managed to lower the cost. They lowered the cost and the time that a patient spends in the hospital. So the ultimately, as of this year, the cost to produce a new knee at that hospital is now $8,700. And the hospital stay is, you know, for somebody who's getting a new knee, is on average, it's just almost a day shorter.
Okay, so how much were they charging insurance companies before they did this?
Yes, hospital charges. So hospitals have what's called a list price,
mm-hmm.
and that's the you can think of it like a sticker price.
Right.
And so they did have a sticker price at the beginning. You know, so if we go back to kind of the at the start,
right,
before they lowered their costs, they had a sticker price of about $50,000.
So they found out that they found out it was costing them $10,500 on the high end, but they were charging. They were asking. That was their first ask, was $50,000. That's a negotiation point, though, right?
Right. That is correct. So there are lots of ways that hospitals and insurance companies, they have lots of strategies for how they negotiate prices. But one of the strategies that they use is they will start with that asking price, and they will negotiate for something lower. And so, so this was their.
But it wasn't $10,500, and it probably wasn't even under $20,000.
Well, I did ask. That was not information that I got. I can say that, you know, like there is some research out there, not specifically about this hospital. You know, I don't want to, but there is some research out there that shows, you know, maybe the asking price is double what someone might actually pay.
Okay, we are talking to Melanie Evans. She's a hospital reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she wrote a piece this week about the cost of knee surgery and the price of knee surgery. We're going to be back in a moment with Melanie. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We hear a lot about healthcare market-based systems, but how can a market system work if the business delivering the service doesn't even know its own costs? A new piece published by the Wall Street Journal details how Gundersen Health Systems in La Crosse went about figuring out how much it costs were for knee replacement surgery, which is one of the most common in the U.S. They found that their costs were a lot less than they thought, and they found that they could cut waste even more. Should all hospitals do this? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We want to hear your stories about tangling with hospital costs or trying perhaps to get the hospital to talk to you about what the price of your procedure was before you had it. We're talking with Melanie Evans, who is a hospital reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Now, Melanie, we ended just a few minutes ago with talking about it, the list price that hospitals put out is often twice as much as they will settle for with the insurance companies for. But one of the things about your piece that I found really interesting, there are all these charts that show for knee replacement surgery how much different hospitals or different areas around the country are charging, and it's not all the same.
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of interesting research about how healthcare prices and spending vary across the United States, and a lot of very smart people are asking questions about, well, why is this the case? And so, when it comes to knee surgery, there was some work done by the Healthcare Pricing Project. It's a group of researchers, and they actually got access to a big database of what privately insured individuals are paying for knee replacement, mm-hmm. and a couple of other services. And they looked at knees and a few other hospital services because it's a pretty standard procedure, right? So if you can think about all the things that might go into the price of a surgery, you know, some patients might be more complicated than others. Some procedures might be more complicated than others. But with knee replacements, it's a pretty standard procedure. And so they kind of looked at they looked at this particular procedure, and they kind of did some work to make sure that they were kind of adjusting their calculations for the fact that some patients are, you know, more complicated or have more, it might be sicker than others. And still, they found knee replacement prices were, like you said, kind of all over the map. And it raises this question, why is that the case? And one of the reasons, might be, some hospitals, you know, when they go to negotiate with insurance companies, they may have they may come into those negotiations with more bargaining leverage. When I talk to hospitals about what goes into those price negotiations, they say it's things like they are looking at, you know, where their prices fall in the marketplace, you know, how they compare, sort of possibly they want to sort of maybe be, you know, they don't want to be too high, they don't want to be too low. Mm-hmm. They may also look at their kind of overall margins. There are.
I would assume there are some places that are just more expensive to live in and
yes,
have a business in than others.
Yes, that's an excellent point. I should have made that point as well. They so in some of the work that I did, so many data points.
I know.
But in some of the reporting that I did, just kind of looked at work where they were adjusting for regional variation in the cost of labor. Right. And so it's very interesting that these prices are so variable, and it raises this, it leaves open this question, like, could some of them be lower?
Yeah. Well, here's my question is that if a knee replacement surgery is a knee replacement surgery is a knee replacement surgery, and it doesn't matter if it happens here in Madison, Wisconsin, or Las Vegas, Nevada, or Austin, Texas, then why not just have a standard price for a knee replacement surgery?
Well, so, and I should make one other point, which is that, you know, the quality also varies, right? So, one of the things that this research that I just cited did is they tried to control for the quality of the hospital, right? So I should also make that point that that when, you know, these researchers were looking at how prices varied, they did try to control for this fact that, like, you know, some hospitals just might be, they might just get better results than others. And so that may also kind of factor into the price. I don't want to exclude that point.
Can we, though, standardize hospital quality? I mean, one of the things that you talked about in your piece was when Gunderson looked at what it was doing, they found things that they were doing that sort of messed up the process and maybe hindered patient recovery or at least made it elongated patient recovery, and then they fixed those things. They sort of cleaned the pipeline. Can all hospitals kind of do this and share that with each other and standardize this process?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the work that Gunderson did was actually part of kind of a group of a couple dozen hospitals that were doing exactly that. So not only they were working with an organization called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement out of Boston. It's a nonprofit. And they were all these hospitals volunteered to, like, drill down on their costs and then share, like, where what worked and what didn't so that they could all standardize. And a lot of hospitals are doing that work. So that is an excellent point that one of the areas that hospitals are looking at is, you know, they ask the question, what is it that we know about the best way to do a procedure? And then they kind of go back and look at how they do it and ask, you know, is there anything we could do differently?
We are talking to Melanie Evans, who is a hospital reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She wrote about a hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin, who looked at the minute-by-minute, person-by-person costs of a knee replacement surgery and found out that it was actually a lot less than they thought it was. They also found places where they could lower the cost. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Andrea from Dubuque, Iowa. Welcome to the program, Andrea.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this real quick and take my answer off the air. So I had a cut on my index finger. I live in Dubuque. I was in Madison, Wisconsin. I needed to go to Mercy Hospital. I had to go to the ER because of the hour of the day. I had two stitches placed on my knuckle. I asked the nurse if I could remove the stitches myself. He said, certainly, you can. I went home. I got a bill. The original bill was $1,300,
oh my
a little
God.
Bit over that. My insurance through Cisco worked with them, to get the bill down to $700. So now I'm expected to pay a $700 bill for two stitches on my index finger that I was advised I could take out myself, and I did take out myself because I didn't want to go back. And so basically I'm looking for advice from me because I was advised that they had a coding system of 1 to 5 at the hospital and told me that I was a certain number but couldn't really explain in detail how they actually coded my visit. And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Andrea. I'm really sorry for that. $700 for a couple of stitches in her knuckle seems excessive to me. Melanie?
Well, Andrea, thanks for the call. So you learned a lot. I mean, you were really, it sounds like you really put a lot of time into understanding the bill, negotiating with your insurance company, calling and getting information about billing codes. That is a lot of work. And, you know, this is sort of like maybe a classic example of the ways that, like, individual patients struggle to understand the high cost of U.S. healthcare. And Andrea, I wish that I had a better answer for you.
I gotta tell you, I don't know that that she was, like, you know, motivated to do the work because she was interested. I would have done the work after I picked myself up off the floor after seeing that $1,300 bill.
Well, yeah, but I mean I think the point is that it's a lot of work to, you know,
right,
to kind of go through those steps, right? Call the insurance company, try to negotiate for something lower, call the hospital company, get to somebody within the hospital who can sort of explain something to you, and then you get an explanation that you don't understand that has to do with billing codes, which are wildly complex.
Yes.
Right? And you're still left with $700 bill, right? And so it sort of speaks to this extremely complex system we have that can be frustrating and confusing and ultimately expensive.
We are talking to Melanie Evans. She wrote a piece yesterday in the Wall Street Journal detailing how a hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin, took a deep dive look at how much it cost them to do knee replacement surgery, and they were surprised by the results. Could this have a wide-ranging impacts on other hospitals, on the healthcare system as a whole? We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have some calls coming in, and we're going to be taking them in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Checking the WPR weather forecast for today, mostly sunny and breezy. We'll have highs in the 70s. Thursday, sunny during the day, but then becoming cloudy late in the day. Highs from the mid-70s to the low 80s. Friday, cloudy skies, showers, and a few thunderstorms across the region, with highs in the low to mid-70s. On Saturday, it'll be cloudy with some rain showers possible in the morning, then a little bit of sun coming through in the afternoon. Highs from the low 70s to the low 80s.
Coming up at 7, the National Land and Water Conservation Fund expires in September. It's been around since 1964, and it's helped Wisconsin build much of its outdoor recreation. That's after 7 on The Morning Show. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. A hospital administrator in La Crosse wanted to know what the hospital's cost was for a common procedure, knee replacement surgery. So she set about tracking every part of the procedure, from the prep to the discharge instructions. And what they found surprised them. The list price was roughly $50,000 for the procedure that only cost them about $10,000. And they found they were doing some steps that not only cost them more, but hindered patient recovery. We're taking your calls about your hospital issues and what you've been charged before. Have you ever tried to find out before a procedure what it costs and what did the hospital tell you? 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Melanie Evans, we do have some calls here, and I'm going to take one. Mark from Oconomowoc, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Just wanted to preface my comment with a real quick story. Recently, I had to take my son into the ER, and of course, for all things, it was because a piece of steak was stuck in his esophagus. Ooh. We were there for about 3 hours, and I just wanted to say what the retail bill came out to when I asked the hospital to send me the detailed bill was $11,800.
Wow.
The insurance discount came down to, and this is what I paid, was $3,800, which still seems pricey.
Right.
I would like to see a legislative move that would state that all providers of health care that provide billable codes would need to publish a retail price, which means if you start seeing $11,000 for a three-hour simple ER visit, that those prices might percolate down if they actually had to publish them.
So legislation might help. Thank you on that, Mark. Melanie, would legislation help?
Well, so... So this is pretty interesting. There, I want to make sure I'm speaking correctly, but so there is an effort to have hospitals post list prices publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, that would be that it may actually fall under some recent regulation for hospitals coming out of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So this is actually kind of a question that a lot of people ask, which is if those list prices are posted, how useful would they be? And to the caller's point, you know, having these prices posted just may be kind of a useful maybe indicator. It sounds like in his case, what he was thinking was that if he could see that, he would just kind of have a frame of reference for which he could sort of understand kind of the expected price.
Right. But here's my question, though. His son had a piece of steak stuck in his esophagus and was in pain, and they had to go to the emergency room. I am not going to sit down and go through comparisons of the various hospitals in the area when I've got a kid who needs to go to the emergency room. I'm going to go to the emergency room, and I'm not going to expect an $11,000 bill for 3 hours. Melanie?
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Wait, I'm so sorry. Could I ask you to repeat that?
Yeah. So I'm like, if I'm having an emergency, I'm not going to be checking prices.
That is a fair point. That is absolutely a fair point. That's a fair point. Sorry.
Okay. So we're going to take another call. Wayne from Rockland. Welcome to the program, Wayne. Wayne, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good.
My question is, why do hospitals have to be so elaborate to build them? Like, they built one in La Crosse here with a big glass front. They spent millions of dollars on it. Why don't they build them cheaper, just a square box, and then save money on patient costs?
Why do the actual hospitals themselves, the buildings themselves, is that what you're asking about? Why are they
why do the buildings have to be so, with marble floors and all this?
Oh, okay. I had a little trouble hearing. I think
Yeah, so what you're saying, you're asking, you know, why spend so much money on the buildings?
Right, marble floors and yes, and, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, one answer might be that that they're hoping to attract more patients, right?
Right.
But I think the caller's point is that that comes with a cost.
I find it interesting that that hospitals don't necessarily know the cost, and insurance companies do. Insurance companies pay different things because they negotiate differently with hospitals.
Yes. So so when it comes to negotiation between hospitals and insurance companies, those are confidential negotiations. And what happens is that there are, as I sort of mentioned earlier, that there are different strategies that they use to negotiate. One of them being the asking price, negotiating down from the from that initial list price. And the degree to which the size of that discount might depend on how much business the insurance company has. So if they have a lot of people, maybe they get a bigger discount.
I want to switch though right now to talking from insurance companies to doctors themselves. One of the things you detail in your piece is I'm going to just read this, actually. The hospital slashed its cement cost by 57% by switching to a generic, which research shows can be used in most cases with the same results. Staff can hand mix antibiotics into the generic cement when needed. This is cement that puts the actual knee apparatus onto the knee. I feel like if I'm reading this from a doctor's point of view, that a doctor may not be too pleased by this efficiency measure because you're putting in extra steps, and extra steps could possibly mean more possibilities for mistakes. And also, a doctor may want to use that particular cement for a reason because they have had bad experiences with the generic cement. What are you hearing from doctors?
Yeah, so the physicians that I spoke to, and one of them quoted in the article, basically said he was kind of perplexed that they would not use the generic. So he had used the generic successfully previously. He didn't actually know that they weren't using the generic.
Right. He just said, "Give me the cement."
Yeah. And in this case, what they did is. They looked at basically the literature. They looked at all the research studies around the use of this cement, and basically found it is acceptable, it is okay to use this type of cement, and there isn't really a need. There's no better result you get from using the fancier. The fancier bone cement with the antibiotics premixed in, so it just was adding cost.
We've got one more call, and I need you to tell you, James, to make it quick. We've got like a half a second.
Okay.
Welcome to the program, though.
All right. Twice I've got the clinics that have been telling me that if I pay them directly, it would be cheaper than my copay with the insurance. And I'm wondering how much does the insurance bureaucracy contribute to the high cost of medical
work? Great question. Thank you,
James,
sir.
That's so interesting. So administrative costs is absolutely, there's like, people are looking very, very closely at that to try to understand, like, what is the role of that administrative cost. I will say this very quickly. Some employers are trying to negotiate directly with hospitals and clinics, like basically sort of. And some hospitals have sort of considered how to do this, where they just essentially are trying to go straight from, you know, essentially the people getting the care right. to the people providing the care.
We have been talking to Melanie Evans. She is a hospital reporter for The Wall Street Journal. One of her latest pieces is, what does knee surgery cost? Few know, and that's a problem. This is a really fascinating piece, and we're going to have a link on our website. I'm going to also put it on Twitter. Thank you, Melanie, for being with us today.
Carrie, thanks so much.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.